The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Great to be here. And we have a very good and informative and exciting show to give to you tonight with Bob Zimmerman at the helm. And he will start in just a few minutes. But there's a couple of announcements, of course, that we need to go through. So for those of you who want to talk with Bob, challenge Bob, worship Bob, whatever you want to do, that toll-free line is available, 1-866-687-7223. These shows work better with your phone calls than emails. Now, how many times do y'all hear me say that? But I'm going to give out the phone number again, 1-866-687-7223. And email for tonight is drspace@thespaceshow.com. I'm going to skip a lot of the other announcements. I want to spend more time talking with Bob, but let me just say that the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and we exist because many of you financially support the show. And if you like the program and you think these programs are important and you listen to them, help support us. I mean, you may think you're getting a free ride, and that's wonderful, but they do cost money to produce. And if you don't support us, we may disappear. So we do need your support. I hate doing fundraising, and I'd hate doing pledge breaks like on NPR. But we need your support, and that is what keeps us on the air. So remember, we're a 501c3, which means that if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And for those of you in California, in the Golden State, or the once Golden State, depending on your perspective, we're a public benefit corporation. So if you make a contribution to us and you pay taxes in California, you also get a tax deduction. And your money goes to keeping our programs on the air. And we thank you very, very much for your support. Let me also skip a couple of other things to tell you that we are trademarked and copyrighted, and you can freely share our programming. So you can actually send full shows to people you think should hear them. They're about 25 megabytes per show, so it's a little hard to send by email, or you can just send people the URL. There are some very simple but important rules about sharing our programs and what you can do. So one of them is, please don't do anything commercial with our programs. The big one is no edits, and then taking those edits or clips and posting them up on YouTube or some other website, including your own. And if you absolutely have some burning reason to do that with a show, email me and get permission if you can before you do it. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And read our full copyright statement. It's at the bottom of every one of our website pages, as well as our parents' website pages, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And then podcasting is with Gigadial. We're in iTunes and a host of other places. Happy to field your podcasting questions if you have them. And best way to do that is to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then we do have sponsors. And again, I ask you to, from time to time, read our sponsors' banner ads. Click on them and see what they offer. They're on the website. I also call your attention to listener voices. We don't talk about that very much on the website, but many of you who supported the building of the new website took out an option called listener voices, and you can post a 1-minute comment in your own voice on listener voices if you took out that perk. Interestingly, only a few of you who took out that perk have bothered to do it. But you paid for it, so why don't you do it? And it's at the bottom of the right side menu bar. So go scroll down to the bottom and check out the people that are giving us a message on listener voices. And those of you that have posted a listener voices, we told you you could update it every quarter. Hello, where are you? Your listener voice message has been there since early January, and you've not bothered to update it. So much for getting value for your contribution. We have it there for you to use. Okay, sponsors for the first part of our show tonight, Integrated Space Analytics. They do have the Integrated Space Plan, which we talk about all the time on the program. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a space-faring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Their website is thespaceplan.com. It's all one word. You can also buy a full color poster of the plan. It comes in two sizes. So again, check them out, thespaceplan.com. And then Orbital ATK is a sponsor, and congratulations on your 5-segment booster test, which you just completed. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Our guest tonight is a gentleman who has been on the space show more than any other person other than me. So he really does not need any introduction unless this is the first space show program you have ever listened to. Robert Zimmerman is back with us. He's a very well-known, highly regarded space historian, author, news person. His website is a must for daily or multiple daily checking, BehindTheBlack.com. It deals with space, science, and a lot of other matters, including political issues. It's not just strictly related to space. He's an award-winning author. His bio is up on the website, and you can read about it in detail. But it's far more fun and colorful and exciting to hear Bob and talk with him. And if you recall, the last time he was on the show, he told us he was writing a policy paper that he would be giving before a think tank pretty soon. Well, he finished his policy paper. He presented it to the think tank. It's been on Behind the Black, and we're going to talk about it in the first segment of the program tonight. And then in the second segment, we will talk about some very exciting planetary developments. So, Bob, welcome back to your 1,000,000th visit to the space show.
Oh, thank God it's not that many. Yeah, you haven't even done that many shows, Dave.
That's right. I'm coming up on, I'm not yet at 3,000. I'm just a little under 3,000.
Oh, I maybe have done 100% of that, one-tenth of 1%.
I don't know. Your show tonight is number 2,728.
Okay. Well, anyway, yes, I've done a lot of your shows, and which I really appreciate, and I appreciate the listeners who listen in and call and question and challenge me and tell me I'm wrong, because, you know, I can be. But I gave a presentation of the policy paper. The paper itself will be published in the next month or so. By August is what they say their schedule is. It's called Exploring Space in the 21st Century, and the subtitle is How the American Space Effort Since 2000, Both Public and Private, is Changing the Global Aerospace Industry. And my goal with this policy paper was to outline in detail what has been happening, what the effort that both the federal government and private enterprise has been doing to create for the United States a robust launch industry since the turn of the century, the last 15 or so years. And that effort is essentially three-pronged. One of the prongs is the Air Force, the military, and the EELV program. And that program created a single entity of the only two launch companies, U.S. launch companies, that existed at the time and around the turn of the century, and that was Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and they unified into the United Launch Alliance, and they got a monopoly to launch all military satellites. That was one prong to try to save or maintain the U.S. launch industry. And then NASA, since George Bush's announcement in 2005, has had two prongs. One prong has been, first it was Constellation / Orion, then it became, or I should say Aries / Orion, and then it became SLS / Orion. And that's basically a NASA-built rocket inspired by the Saturn V, Saturn IB, and Apollo capsule system used in the 60s. And government-built, government-designed, getting multiple contractors, essentially dictated by Congress after the Obama administration tried to cancel it. And so that's why SLS exists. That's one of NASA's prongs. And the other prong from NASA is commercial space, whereby NASA doesn't design or build anything. It becomes merely a customer and buys the product from other companies to get cargo and crews up and down to ISS. And so those are the three prongs. And what I wanted to do was look, especially with the NASA effort, the two NASA efforts, I wanted to very closely compare them in terms of their cost, their development time, and what they produced in that for that cost and development time. And I recognize that the goals of Orion and SLS are different than the cargo and crew capsules going to ISS, but I think that the differences aren't as much to justify the very stark, gigantic differences between the two. And what I did is I analyzed at great length in this policy paper, and once again, this is going to be published in August, and it's going to get distributed. It's from the Center of New American Security in D.C. It's a major think tank. It's a think tank that tends to be somewhat moderate in the middle. It was founded by a Republican and a Democrat. It has a lot of people in it from both administrations. If I had to call it anything, I would call it, and I wrote about this in a long essay on Behind the Black, just my impressions of the think tank. If I had to call it anything, I would call it the establishment think tank, which is interesting that they asked me to do this, because when I gave my presentation, I was told by people that there were a lot of big space industry people in the audience, and that they were really upset at what I had to say, because I was attacking at great length the big space standard old-fashioned way of doing things in my policy paper. Well, this is going to get published. It's going to get distributed throughout Washington, and hopefully with the election and afterward, it's going to have a great deal of influence, because my goal with this is to point out how little we are getting bang for the buck with the old way of doing things, both with EELV and Orion SLS. And so what I did is I analyzed the cost, and the cost has to do with not just the contractual cost, which I did analyze as well for both programs, SLS Orion versus commercial space, but the overall appropriated money that Congress has given NASA based upon NASA's requests, essentially. And I added those numbers up to get a real clear idea of what it was. I also looked at the total number of things produced and how long it took to produce it. If you compare just Orion SLS with the cargo contracts for Dragon and for Cygnus from Orbital ATK and from SpaceX, and I grant you, once again, I recognize they have different goals, and I'll get to that in a minute, but I want to just point out the difference. Orion SLS is going to produce three flight capsules and two rockets, because it used the Delta IV for the first, didn't develop a new rocket for that, for its first flight. It's going to take it 15 years for the first manned flight, which is essentially when the program becomes, you could say, operational. And that's assuming the flight will happen in 2021, and I have a lot of information that tells me it's going to be delayed till 2023, which would mean it would be 17 years to get the first manned launch off. And assuming it's in 2021, the cost for that over the period of time from the moment they gave the first contract for Orion to Lockheed Martin back in 2006 is $43 billion. For the cargo contracts, they're producing 22 capsules and 22 rockets. It's going to take, it took them 5 to 7 years to develop it from blank piece of paper to actual first launch, operational launch, and it cost them $4 billion. In other words, it cost them Orion SLS costs 10 times as much, took 3 times longer, and is producing 1/10 the result. Now, you could say, okay, but that's only cargo. It's not manned, and Orion is manned. Well, if you look at the manned for comparison, once again, Orion is 3 capsules, flight capsules, one of which is manned, 2 rockets, 15 to 17 years of development, $43 billion. The entire commercial space program, both manned and unmanned, if you follow the appropriations through the end of the International Space Station program in 2024, will produce 42 capsules, manned and unmanned, 42 flight rockets. The development time for the manned, including the manned craft, will be somewhere between 5 and 9 years. And the total cost for the entire program through the end of the SLS, based on appropriations, assuming maximum appropriations from Congress based on what they have appropriated up to now, the maximum number, I was not conservative, I actually gave it high numbers, $12 billion. So, in other words, Orion SLS will cost 4 times as much, still take about twice as long to build, will produce, what is that? 1/20th the material, between 1/10th and 1/20th the material. And those differences are incredible and stark. And now people will say, well, still, Orion's going to take us to Mars, which it's not, and these are only orbital craft. Well, I then pulled out the numbers for the Apollo and Saturn V and 1B from the 60s. They have the same goals as SLS and Orion. It took... in the 60s, NASA 9 years from first design work to the on the Saturn V engines in 58 to its first test flight in 67 took 9 years. Actual construction took less time, though, because they didn't actually award the contracts for the capsule and the rockets until the 62-63 time frame. So actual construction of the Apollo Saturn V rockets was about 5-6 years from beginning of construction to actual first launch. The total cost, I did some calculations looking at the actual contracts they handed out, and it's about the same. It's hard to, of course, convert dollars from then to now, but from what I can gather, the cost for SLS Orion today is about the same as Apollo then. But the Apollo program included the service module. It included the cost I have included the entire program to the end of the lunar program, plus some rockets that were never launched, capsules that were never launched. It included all the infrastructure, the VAB, the launch pads, communications, mission control, etc., that SLS is taking advantage of now that have already been built. SLS Orion is only, the cost numbers I've given you here only includes the first launch, first operational launch. It has nothing to do with the later missions. It didn't include the service module, which is being built by Europe, and that's only a building only 1.5. And it doesn't include any later operational missions, and it doesn't include any of the infrastructure that is necessary to make the mission operational. So from my mind, SLS Orion really comes off badly in all contexts.
Do you want to take a phone call that you already have waiting?
Well, now, the most important point of the paper, the policy paper, I'm quite willing to take phone calls, but let me give you another 5-6 minutes to talk about why the differences are so profound. And I think it's really important to understand that, because that is important. This is the recommendations my policy paper is going to give to the big honchos, the policy people, the politicians in D.C., and I'm hoping they will pay attention to this, because it might even make SLS Orion function better, by the way, if they accept these recommendations. And that is the differences. What are the differences? Well, commercial cargo and commercial ferrying human manned missions. Ownership. The capsules and rockets are owned by the companies that build them in the commercial program. SLS and Orion is not owned by the companies that build it. In fact, the SLS rocket is a hodgepodge of contracts. You've got it's very complex. You've got 4 different companies building 4 different engines, essentially, for it. And that's because Congress mandated very specific things using infrastructure from the shuttle, as well as other factors. And so it's very expensive to make, and they don't own it. So the only customer is NASA, who dictates the terms of how it's going to be built based upon politics, not efficiency and use. SpaceX builds the Dragon capsule and the Falcon 9 rocket to make money. They sell it to NASA, but they also design it so that it can be efficient and cost-effective to sell it to others as well. So that's one thing. The second thing is simplicity of design. By giving it ownership to these companies, they keep this design simple. I mentioned how many different companies are involved in building the SLS rocket. SpaceX, which built Falcon 9, built one rocket engine and applied it to all the stages. It made that design work much simpler, and it kept it simple in that respect, and that's a way to save money. Then there were the contracts. The commercial crew system had very streamlined contracts, much simpler, much less overhead, much less supervision by NASA, saved a lot of development time and overhead costs. And in fact, I go into this in the policy paper. The overhead for SLS Orion ranges from 50 to 70%. In other words, if you look at the actual contracts charged to the companies building it, and then you look at the actual appropriated numbers, you find that the contracts for the people who are building the rocket and the capsules is only between 30% and 50% of the cost. More than half the cost for that system is NASA overhead. It's a standing army of bureaucrats and employees, many of whom are good engineers, but they're not building anything. They design stuff and they step back, so we have to pay it for it twice. With the commercial space program, the overhead is much less, much less. It ranged between 14 to 30% is what I can estimate. I know that they say themselves for the COTS program, the initial demonstration flights, they had a mandate to try to keep the overhead to only 3%. Now, well, I looked at the actual appropriations versus actual contracts, and it comes up much higher from my number, but they had a goal to try to keep it small. So that's another way to save money that's significant, and Congress should look at that. Plus, the contracts in the commercial field were fixed price and did paid off based on a schedule and milestones, while the SLS and Orion are all cost plus contracts with no deadlines. So any extensions, any delays, any changes, any additional costs, NASA picks up. The company has no incentive to do it fast or cheaply. With fixed price and a mandated schedule of payment, it's an incentive for the private companies to make it work. And finally, the policy paper went into SpaceX's influence in the private launch sector by its lowered cost of launch and how that has completely been an earthquake, shook up the entire launch industry. And that applies now to the commercial space industry, commercial space for NASA. NASA has hired multiple contractors for every step in commercial space, which creates competition. And the competition is what's making things work better than anything you can imagine. SLS, instead of having different companies competing for actual contracts, what they did instead is they divided up the rocket and capsules between all the players. And so each player gets its little territory, and they're safely funded that way. And so they have no incentives to improve their operations or improve efficiency or do it faster or better. They've got a contract. They've got their little territory in their area of success. And so they don't, and the thing costs a lot of money to build for that reason. In commercial space, SpaceX came up with a rocket that was much cheaper and suddenly started to steal market share from everybody. And so everybody now is racing to try to come up with a better way to launch rockets themselves so that they can compete. And now, I've said this many times on your show, but what I did for the policy paper is I went through the history very, very detailed to document that actual series of events and how SpaceX's arrival has unequivocally shook the whole launch industry in a positive way to lower cost. In fact, today on the John Batchelor Show, I pointed out how the Russians are considering what they call a proton light. In order to lower cost, it would be a simpler rocket to launch and would save money and therefore maybe be more competitive. And this has gone through the entire industry, and I went through that with the policy paper, so in detail. So, all right, now to sum up, David, so we can take calls in the second half hour if people might want to.
Yeah, well, they want to talk with you now. So, you
all right, now just to sum up, this is going to come out in August, and it's going to, I think, shake some boats, rock some boats, and I hope it will, because I think for the sake of our space program and our federal government and our budget, we need to rethink how we're doing some things in space, and I think this is hopefully going to make people do that. So I'll love to talk to who's ever on the phone now. Let's go for it.
Caller, thank you for waiting. Who are you, and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is John Benick. I'm with the Vote for Space organization in Dallas, Texas.
Okay. What was the name of your space organization?
Vote for Space.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
So my question is about, you know, let's say that you explain this argument very clearly and no one can refute it and the data is all there. It still doesn't change these incentives that you've talked about, which is, you know, the players have divided up the rocket and they've each got their piece and they've got their senator going for it. And so how, you know, what's the incentive for anyone to, you know, yield to reality here as opposed to maintain the status quo?
Well, John, I'll tell you, the thing that's really made a difference is that we do have two different ways of doing things, both in operation right now, but that the government is funding, and they are working very differently from each other, and they are a great thing to compare. And so you say, what's to change the status quo? But we have two status quos right now. We have commercial space is one status quo doing it one way, and we have the big space 60s model of SLS Orion. It's doing it another way, and one way is far more successful. And so to change the status quo here, it's just a matter of Congress and the next administration looking at the situation honestly and making a decision to stop funnel money into one and instead funnel money into the other. And they don't have to fund a lot. You see, that's another thing I point out. The commercial space operation has not had a lot of money. In fact, Congress has generally not given the administration what it requested. But I don't think that's been a harmful thing in the slightest. It's kept the reins tight. It's forced them to be efficient. You don't give them a blank check. It's the worst thing you can do. And so I think that this comparison illustrates the better way to do things. We have now a demonstrated model of a better way to do things, and that's what I'm hoping Congress and the next administration will recognize and start to use that knowledge to improve how we do things in space.
Okay. Do you have some recommendation for the place of, for example, Marshall Space Flight Center in a more commercial paradigm?
Well, okay. I'm pretty blunt in my policy paper. Congress has got to reduce its overhead for space. It's not producing anything for us. NASA should be simply a customer, should buy the product from the private sector. In that context, the Congress should cut that overhead significantly. It might mean significant cuts to the NASA infrastructure, because I think a lot of that infrastructure has not been productive for itself and for the nation. I've been watching for many, many years, and I've been very closely in contact with NASA centers and people there for many years, and what I've seen in a lot of cases is just a waste of money. That's not, I always emphasize this, this is not trying to denigrate the people there, because I think a lot of them are brilliant. The engineering coming out of NASA is brilliant. But we're not getting good bang for our buck. And in fact,
I think a lot of these people
would be better served.
Recognize the same principles that you're pointing out. In the meantime, they're getting a paycheck and have got, you know, children to send to college. And it seems like, you know, if you can carve out some place for them in a new paradigm where, you know, ideally the space economy is growing anyway, then you might not encounter as much resistance to people who, at the end of the day, have mouths to feed.
You're right. One of the ways, the paradigm that would work best is if the cost to get into space is less, it means you can get, and I point this out, and this is happening in the private sector, the launch market. If you lower the cost to launch, it means that more customers can afford to launch product. You get more customers, you can therefore have more launch companies because they can compete better. And the industry starts to grow. This is exactly what happened in the computer industry. And so what's the paradigm for these people? As I pointed out already, they are brilliant. They're good engineers. They would get jobs elsewhere. They could even create their own companies. And I've talked to enough people in the industry to know that a lot of them would be very happy having their own companies competing in the market. It's kind of like there's a shock to the system, but there is definitely plenty of work to go around if they get out of the umbrella of the easy government job that's not producing very much and actually go and make things. I'm very cold-hearted about this. I know I sound that way, and I realize politically this is going to be very difficult. And I do not expect it to happen quickly. But if, but I do think that we have to be honest about this and be forthright. I will tell you, I went to a AIAA conference about a year ago to give a keynote speech. It was actually happening the same week as a New Space conference, and I didn't go to that. I went to this instead. And this is an industry conference, AIAA. It's mostly people in the big space companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and it was at in California. And I was giving a talk where I was specifically talking something to the same effect as this. And I honestly expected to get a lot of resistance. And in fact, I got just the opposite. In fact, they had a lobbying, not a lobbying group, but a group that's supposed to educate congressional people, from the big industry companies. And their position was exactly the same as mine. They wanted more commercial space. They did not want big SLS projects. They wanted more commercial space. They wanted it run under the commercial space framework because it produces things. They're engineers. They want to build. They want to cut metal. They don't want to sit there and twiddle their thumbs, with the bureaucracy that they're stuck in at NASA. So that's where I stand. I mean, you know.
Well, and now there are a lot of companies that, stand to gain from this shift that you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, how, are they supporting you? Are you courting their support? You know, how do you kind of amplify?
Well, the paper
the
hasn't been published. I've been talking about this kind of stuff, as David well knows, for more than a decade. David and I, when I wrote my first book, Genesis: Story of Apollo 8, back in '98, I concluded with my conclusions were private space is the way to do things. You're not going to get it done with big government programs, and I've been making this point for a decade. And the private, what this policy paper. The decisions that NASA made in late 2008 to give out commercial cargo contracts to Orbital A, first initially to Kistler rocket plane and then to Orbital ATK and to SpaceX, was a key decision because it allowed for the last decade an alternative, exactly what I've been saying, to be demonstrated. And my policy paper is outlining in detail how successful that approach has been. And so there is plenty of opportunity to have success using that paradigm. And there's plenty of people who want to go into space and do work in space and be very productive. And a robust launch industry, not a space program, but a robust, chaotic launch industry, is going to be the best way to produce as much work as possible for as many people. And that will benefit the country.
My final question is, what's your outlook on, you know, the next NASA administrator? People suggest it might be Lori Garver, and how she might feel about these topics.
Well, the problem with that question is that I haven't the faintest idea who is going to win the election.
Okay.
And so I can't even tell you. So your first question, predicting the administrator, can't be made because I don't know who the administration will be. And I will tell you that both candidates right now, at least of the main parties, are woefully uninterested in this topic. I've looked at their statements, and the only one who's made any statement of any substance on space was Donald Trump. But substance is an overstatement. He did say, though, that he likes the fact that private enterprise is doing such great things. But to try to draw a conclusion or a prediction of what's going to happen from that is almost impossible. I will say that Lori Garver was, when she came in the Obama administration, she and that administration worked very hard to keep the commercial space program alive and put their emphasis on that. They wanted to kill Constellation and Orion and were forced by Congress to keep it. But they were very much in favor of commercial space, and I think they were right in that respect. Now, what's going to happen in the next administration? I have no idea. I once again say that the policy paper is going to be distributed throughout Washington, and it's going to point out what's been working and what has not been working. And hopefully we have some people in the elected and apparatchiks in Washington, D.C., who have interest in trying to do something that works. That's my hope.
John, what
okay, well, thank you very much.
I appreciate the question. I'm open to suggestions, absolutely.
John, don't hang up. What is Vote for Space?
Okay. Yeah, tell us.
What is Vote for Space?
Sure. Vote for Space is a political action committee whose goal is to kind of coordinate the policy guidance of people such as yourself, of companies, of advocacy organizations, and grow a consolidated block of citizens who haven't yet been directed with specific policy guidance to give their representatives in their regional districts. So I was at the New Space Conference last week and made some great connections with people, built some online social media technology at voteforspace.com, and my goal is to promote settlement of outer space, and I've got 14 issues listed on my website. You know, you do have to pick and choose sometimes when there are competing priorities, but right now I am establishing more formal relationships with industry sponsors and advocacy organizations to hopefully have this cohesive message. I was an employee of the Boeing company, and Brewster Shaw, who was the president, came into our meeting and told us about how he was working with Lockheed Martin and ATK. And you know what? That provided my paycheck. And I witnessed firsthand how, you know, that relationship between the legislators and the constituents. And so what I'm trying to do is take this larger community that isn't necessarily organized by the financial incentives that, you know, being a public company brings, but still take a cohesive message and have it coming through on multiple channels to lots of different legislators.
I would love to be able to chat with you at greater length and also exchange emails at some point to discuss this, since we have I think we have the same goals. David does, you know, to have a robust spacefaring society, hopefully very American influenced, because our ideas as a nation are good ones. So I would love to talk about this. I think you'll find my policy paper when it comes out illuminating.
What is your website again? What's your website again?
VoteForSpace.com.
Okay.
And you know that mine is BehindTheBlack.com.
Yes, yeah, I found that on thespaceshow.com.
Yes. All right, it's voteforspace.com. All right, we will, I'm sure, link up. And if you have,
I can't get there. I'm trying, and, now I finally got there using Chrome.
Oh, there you go.
I couldn't get there on Internet Explorer.
I've got some high-tech stuff there. What I'm doing is I have this page inspired by Mission Control. You know, I work in Mission Control, and I'm trying to get the geography of different participants and events on a map, along with information about who the legislators are, and then kind of a ticker of forum discussions, another list of events, and then another list of avatars of different people. And I believe that if I can get all of that information on the same page, which I have done, if you go up to the action link, then it'll cross that tipping point to get the conversion of people to donate and or go to an event or reach out and connect with someone else in the community. And a lot of these people are really empty vessels. You know, they haven't spent the decades that you have, you know, understanding space policy and history. They just think space is cool. And so what I want to do is to kind of fill that empty vessel with a true story and then give people something to do about it.
Yeah. Very interesting. I'm looking at your page right now.
Great.
I have to tell you that right now, there's a theme I have on Behind the Black, which I call the competition heats up when I post stories about things going on. And there is no doubt in my mind, based on what has been going on for the last 5 years, that and I said this 5 years ago when the Obama administration tried to cancel Constellation and the government stepped in, the Congress stepped in and forced SLS to occur. I said we're going through now a very difficult transition away from big space to a private sector achievement. And I think right now we're about to come out of that transition, and it's going to get really, really exciting and crazy. And the crazy is a positive statement. It's going to be all action of all kinds all the time in the next few years. I mean, just SpaceX decision that they're going to be launching a Dragon capsule, that every launch opportunity to Mars gives you a sense of what is coming in the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
And that combined with Blue Origin alone, and it's going to get really, really exciting. And I want the government to understand why, and it has nothing to do with a government space program, that this is happening. And that's my goal, at least, mm-hmm. here, John.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's almost a, you know, hopefully an inevitability about the success of rich, motivated people like Bezos and Elon Musk. And I think that the opportunity here is to, you know, capture some of the money that Congress is spending and some of the energy from these entrenched, established corporations like Lockheed and Boeing to capture that and kind of marshal it into, you know, one positive direction rather than kind of maybe an embarrassing, you know, hitting the wall. Like has happened with so many NASA programs in the past. You know, I was a youngster when the X-33 program got canceled.
Yeah.
And that was very, you know, formative for me because I was so excited about it. And I was like, wait a minute, you know, this political thing happened and this has nothing to do with the technical nature of any of this.
Yeah. The key there is, once I said, is ownership. The Lockheed Martin really didn't own the X-33, though there was an attempt to try to make it own it by having them invest money in it. That idea was being to lurk on the edges there. But they really didn't own it. It wasn't being built for a profit. It was being built for a NASA goal. And when the politics changed, NASA's goals changed, and it died. And there wasn't willingness to invest the capital to fix the engineering questions that had come up. The idea here is that the ownership has to belong to the companies, that they can make a profit. And then they make a profit. Look, Bigelow's a great example of that. Bigelow's trying to make a profit with habitable stations. He's going to, wants to sell it to countries, to NASA, but he also then can sell it to the private sector as well. And there's money to be made then. And then suddenly the government can then get what it wants for a lot less. And that's very important. It's the most important. One of the most important points in the policy paper is that we should not have a blank check. We should not be asking for more money. We should be talking about how we can spend less more wisely, because we can do this for less. The government is out of control.
You know, Boeing, Bigelow's a great example. Boeing itself
has a lot of money at NASA and SLS.
They've got their commercial capsule. You know, their CST-100. And they have advanced ideas for, you know, private space station derived, you know, interplanetary habitats. And so, you know, Boeing wants to make money too. And I think that Boeing sees an opportunity to make more money by aligning the contracts that they get with NASA with real commercial market opportunities. So
you're absolutely correct. Boeing, in fact, I kind of jokingly call a schizophrenic company, because it's a large company with many different divisions, and some of the divisions in Boeing are very smartly trying to be on the ride the wave of the private sector and profit. And the Starline CST-100 is one example of that. Their deal with Bigelow for that private habitat is an example of that. And I think they are definitely on the side of ULA's attempt to try to make the rockets, the Atlas V, more efficient. But there is a whole other side to Boeing that has to do with SLS, which is the old school. And I think the company is schizophrenic in that way. And I think the whole business industry, aerospace industry, is kind of schizophrenic in this way. It's kind of divided, split personality. And I think we have to begin to look at what works and what doesn't and let the bad part go away. It will take care of itself. It will not starve. It will actually suddenly begin to produce great things because it will find the right way.
Right.
Guys, I got to move on. So
yeah, thank
other
you,
people
okay.
want to get in on the show. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Listener, if you are still listening and you want to call in, and we do want you to call in or send your email, 1-866-687-7223. The line is clear, so have at it. And
any email questions?
No. No, well, you guys have been going on and on and on, and I don't, I guess...
Well, we haven't been talking foolishly. It's been good stuff, I think.
People are either satisfied or they're no longer listening.
Well, you know, I can't do anything about that.
Well, you can, and I can too. You can make yourself more interesting.
Well, yeah, I think that from anyone who's interested in space, this is got to be, if you're interested in trying to produce a space program, a space industry, a spacefaring society, this has got to be interesting to you, because once again, the policy paper, I really went into even greater detail than I have for the last 5 years, and more than that, last 20 years since I've been writing about space. I really dug in and tried to document the numbers so that I could get it right. And it wasn't any different than I knew, but I now have it documented very precisely.
Well, I would suspect that people who don't agree with you probably tune it out.
Yeah, I think that's the case. But you know, what John pointed out is that a lot of the policy people and a lot of the politicians don't really know a lot here.
Well, clearly. I have people that email me that have gone to these different, you know, citizen lobbying groups of either state legislatures or even the U.S. Congress. And they usually have talking points that they're supposed to talk about, which SLS is not among them, but say space settlement is. But most of the people that they talk with are not really that familiar with hardly anything about space.
Yeah.
Even if they're the space advisor for the representative,
right.
It's really frightening how many of the congressional offices have staffers that advise the member on issues that they know very, very little about.
This is one aspect of this whole thing with the Center for New American Security, because that think tank, its policy papers go to the Hill, to all the
to
people
the
involved. And so this is going to be seen by the staffers who try to advise.
Yeah, but do they read it? Do they pay attention? I mean, who knows?
Of course not. But you know what? It's a data point, and it's going to be a very easy data point for them to digest, because, you know, it's going to be right there in front of them. It's not very hard. You know, I'm a good writer. It's not hard to read. It's not super long. It's not dense, boring stuff. It's very readable and clear. And the tables where I lay out the successes and the results of these various programs are very stark and easy to see. And so what that's going to do is they're going to be staring at this and saying, well, gee, let's think about policy here. You know, I think about someone like Ted Cruz, who's on the Subcommittee on Space and Science and therefore deals with this subject. And Ted Cruz has, even though he's a conservative supposedly and wants to cut back on government, the few things he said about space has tended to suggest that he really doesn't know much about it and he wants a big, exciting space program. But if he's presented these kind of information through his staff or through this policy paper that he sees himself, he'll change on a dime, because he will see what is cost-effective. And I think a lot of congressmen from both parties and senators will also change on a dime when they see how cost-effective the commercial space approach has been. And I lay out why. I'm not just simply saying, do it this way. I'm laying out why specifically those contracts that NASA let to Orbital ATK, to SpaceX, and now to Boeing and to Sierra Nevada have been so much more cost-effective than SLS contracts and the Orion contracts.
See, I think you're delusional, because I think Congress makes policy on issues that are very, very different than just being cost-effective.
Well, you're correct. I am an idealist in this respect. I think that there are some people with ethics in D.C. who will look at this and want to change things. I actually do think there are some. And
really?
I think there's going to be a gigantic inertia and also ill motives by a lot of people in Washington, D.C. to do the wrong thing for their own personal benefit.
I'll tell you, that's the battle.
The next time
you're on the show, you come prepared with a list of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents who you think are ethical in Congress. I would like to know who's on that list.
That is not a topic for your show.
Well, I'm asking it to be bipartisan, so...
No, I agree with you, but that's not a topic for your show. Your show is about space. That's a political...
Well, I just would like to know who you really think, well, then send it to me as a private email.
Yeah, I'll tell you right now, I think that Ted Cruz is actually an ethical guy.
Now, by the way, that's my opinion. Now, remember,
people can disagree with me, but I mentioned him because I think he has certain specific principles about what he thinks government should be doing, and it has to do with not running the affairs of everyone's lives.
Remember,
and if we can get the government and get the government expenses down. If you present him with an alternative that will save the government money and get more accomplished for it, he'll pay attention to that. I could go down the list. There's others as well, and I think they're influential. I hope so.
He wrote most of the commercial space bill that was passed
into
law in 2015. Not most of it, but a good part of it.
He was involved in that, and his goal there was to try to. The goal there was to try to, and I don't think it was successful. I think this is once again where his knowledge is limited. But I think the goal was to try to free up the government, the regulatory control of private space, so that private space can innovate and be free. That was at least the goal. Whether he succeeded, well, you know, we could argue about that. I'm not sure he did, but. The point I'm getting at is that you asked me, I can give you that name right off the bat, and there are others. And I think a lot of the people in the states that have big space industries, if they see a method that succeeds, because one of the problems they've had in recent years is they've been funding these big space programs that haven't accomplished anything, and it's beginning to look ridiculous. They want something to be done. They actually do want, they want their pork to get into their districts, but they can't just keep refunneling pork because sooner or later it's going to backfire on them. And so they, politically. And so they'd like a success. And if they can spend money and get a success, I think they'd be much politically much better off. And I think they recognize that. And I think that's also a motive here. Even those that aren't ethical, if you can point them in a direction that will get them more political gain, they will take it. And I think a successful space industry producing exciting things like SpaceX landing a first stage is something that will get, that will bleed off to the credit of congressmen and senators, and they will take that credit any chance they get.
I was just going to say, listeners, I hope someone will call in who disagrees with you. And you have a caller.
Okay.
Will they disagree or will they agree? What, you want to make a bet?
Hey, I hope they disagree.
I hope they disagree, too.
Yeah. Make good conversation.
Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And do you support or not support what Bob is saying?
Well, you killed him, David.
It's Jim from Huntsville.
Oh, who's that?
Oh, Tim in Huntsville. He's going to rubber stamp everything you said.
So. Oh, well, all right.
I didn't say
that's
that.
Okay.
Well, I just...
Hold.
Okay.
Hold. I'm not going to rubber stamp everything that
Bob is all right.
Says, because Bob Zimmerman is a bit of a critic of Robert Zubrin and going to Mars, and I'm not so much.
All right.
Hey, Tim, stop a minute. Zubrin is on the show Friday, August 22nd. I just booked.
Oh, cool.
Oh,
and I know you like it.
I'm at work at that time.
Well, you can hear the archives, but if you want to ask him a question, email it to me ahead of time.
Okay, I'd like to get his answer.
Don't ask the question now.
Email it to me before Friday, August 22nd. He's on. I'll confirm that during the break, but I think he's on August 22nd.
So, Tim, what do you want to talk to me about?
Okay. You want to say you don't want this to be into politics, right? Because that's what you're telling Dr. Livingston, that you don't want to give him the list of the honest who you think is an honest politician, because that would get into politics. Am I correct?
Yeah, I can't go into that in great length because that's really not what the show is supposed to be about. That's right. If I start to get into politics and the election and who I think is corrupt and not, I'm not talking space there, and that's not appropriate for this venue.
Well, it's...
How about a bipartisan review of Democrats and Republicans who are good on the issue of space?
Well, right now, the problem we have right now is that most of the people in Congress have been focused almost exclusively. They're fighting the last war. That's been the biggest problem. It's not even a question of ethics. They want their pork in their districts, a lot of them. But a lot of them just simply think the only way you can do things is to relive the 1960s space race over and over again. They have this concept of a space program. And so this is not even a question of ethics or unethics or dishonesty or corruption. They always want pork in their districts because they want votes. But put that aside for a minute. They also want a successful space program, a lot of them, because it's prestige for the nation, which bounds back to them. They get the prestige. They get the credit. They become famous. You know, that's what they're there for. They have egos. And so the problem is really that they're all living in the past. They see we got to have a big space program. And so we retired the shuttle, but what worked in the past? Well, it was a Saturn V rocket and an Apollo capsule. So let's do the same again. And that's what they're funding. And I think it's mostly because they just don't know any better and they don't know any alternatives to go by. And that applies to mostly, you know, you got to remember that most of the congressmen and senators who are influential about setting space policy are those that have districts where most of the space industry is, in California, Texas, and Florida. And in a few other places like Georgia and Alabama, where the space industry is mostly centered. Those are the guys and gals that influence the policy because that's where the industry is and that's where the pork is. And so those, and I've looked at these people for years, and most of them, I would say the general problem isn't even corruption, though pork plays a part of that. I could talk about Richard Shelby as the Porkmeister. I do that on my website all the time. I think he has less interest in having a successful space program. He, more than anyone else, is, I'd say, the corrupt one. He's more like pours money into space just to get pork and not doesn't care if anything's accomplished in the slightest. But a lot of them want things accomplished. And if you provide them data to show them there's a better way to do things, I think they'll take it seriously. Because if they can get the pork in their districts, but at the same time do it efficiently so that the public is pleased because we actually have a space program that's doing something, they will look good. If you continue to have this gigantic non-program that costs a fortune, takes forever to launch, doesn't accomplish anything, the public gets very disenchanted and pissed off, as the public is right now, very disenchanted and very pissed off. And so they will respond to good data, and that's how I look at it. And my impression also, being at the in Washington last week at the new Center for New, they have an annual conference, the Center for New American Security. They focus mostly on defense and State Department issues, but they're trying to move out into other areas like space. And so I was there. There was 1,000 Washingtonians at this conference, many speaking, including Joe Biden, including Lindsey Graham and Joe Reed, senators. A lot of other State Department people of some note were there. And you also had a lot of people, policy staffers there, think tank people there. And so I'm there, and industry people who get funding from these. And the sense I get is they are really looking for ways to do things effectively. They have certain accepted wisdoms they follow, which I'm trying to burst some bubbles.
This is the Center for New American Security?
Correct. That's the name of it. And it's a middle-of-the-road, I would say, establishment based politically. It tends to... It has a lot of liberal leanings, but it also has some Republican conservative leanings, so it's mixed. But that kind of puts it middle of the road. Establishment is the word I used earlier. But you know, they asked me to do this paper, and I'm going to hit hard with this idea of we can do things better in our space program, and how, you know, once again, the ideas of ownership and private enterprise and streamlined contracts and et cetera, well, some of that has not been discussed at length in Washington for years. It's either been forgotten, or they just don't think about it, or they don't want to talk about it. Now I'm going to talk about it. I hope that answered your question, Tim, as best as I can.
Oh, there is something else I want to bring up. You mentioned that NASA in 9 years was able to come up with the Saturn V rocket and launch people to the moon, but in 17 years, we can't even do the same with SLS. it with twice the amount of time. And I'm going to read you something that I found that I want to ask if you agree with this or not.
Okay.
It's called Gary Pinnell's Iron Law of Bureaucracy. In any bureaucratic organization, there will be two kinds of people: those who work to further the actual goals of the organization, and those who work for the organization itself.
Yeah.
The Iron Law states that in all cases, the second type of person will always gain control of the organization and will always write the rules under which the organization functions.
Okay. You want me? I absolutely agree with that. And it is actually that process, that one statement describes, is exactly why when a organization like NASA begins, it has a goal which is very strongly ruling the organization, which is get to the moon. And so therefore they do things fast and smart and efficiently. But over time, the organization, the government organizations, bureaucracies always get co-opted and corrupted, and dry rot sets in where the organization becomes the main issue and not the goals. And so when that happens, you no longer do things as effectively as you could. And I'll tell you right now that a lot of the people at NASA who have shifted to goals of the organization instead of the goals of good engineering, if they got out of the organization and they were focusing on goals of engineering again, they'd be happier. And they'd be producing something creative that would be wonderful and something they got into space to begin with to do. You know, and I think they'd agree with me on that.
So if you want to do anything in space, you don't join NASA.
Oh, I've been saying this when I give talks to AIAA student groups. I say this repeatedly. I say, guys, if you're going to get a job in the engineering field, the last place you should go to work right now is NASA. You want to cut metal, you want to design things, you want to create, and you want to see rockets launched, go to private companies. Go to private companies who are not necessarily even doing work for NASA, because that'll get you, you'll have some excitement. If you go to NASA, you might be sitting twiddling your thumbs, filling out paper forms, and dealing with process for the next 25 years. And as John Bennett mentioned, he worked for X-33, and he worked very hard working on that, and boom, politics stepped in, and it got canceled and never flew, and didn't get to finish the engineering work that he was working so hard on. And I think that's one of the problems with government, the government way, the old government way of doing things. Look, SLS Orion, we could very well have the next administration come in, and just like Obama killed Constellation because of the Bush project, the next administration could try to kill SLS because it's not their project. And just like they killed X-33 because it wasn't George Bush's project, and just like, and I could go back many times, that's why you want it to be owned by the private companies, making profit for themselves, and have NASA and the government merely a customer, buys what it needs from private companies and leaves them to make their money selling it to others.
Now, does this hold true for the people doing planetary science sending the space probes out?
That's interesting you bring that up, because one of the reasons that NASA's planetary program has been so successful is that the way they run it, it's competitive. NASA says we want to send a mission to Mars, let's say. And what NASA then does is they put out a request for proposals. And scientists compete. They come up with proposals and they compete against each other. And they've got to put out a proposal that is decent, effective, and cost effective. And so, therefore, their programs are successful. And when they don't do it well, NASA has abandoned, eliminated, changed contractors. They've just fired people and put in new people instead, which is how private competition really works. So that's one of the reasons it's been successful. Has it been as cost-effective as it could be? I actually don't think so, because, once again, it is government nonetheless. But I think it's been successful as it has been because of the competitive nature of how this planetary program and the astronomy computer program generally. Astronomy program is a good example. In the 90s, they did it the same way as the planetary program. They would ask for proposals for space telescopes to have competitive operation, and space telescopes would get built for relatively little money. In the aughts, they decided to go with the giant James Webb telescope, one program, one giant thing, and stop the competition, and that's gone over budget from $1 billion to $9 billion, and it's going to be a decade behind schedule. It's the SLS of the astronomy program. Planetary program has been managed to keep itself focused and competitive and therefore effective and efficient.
So,
And I'm going to talk about planetary programs in the second half of the show, right, David?
I should try to go into the planetary sciences, right?
Yeah.
All right, Tim, I got to take a break. Do you have anything else?
No, that's it.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you, as always.
Listener, your calls are still welcome, and the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Email is also available, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we're going to take a break for 3 minutes. Don't go anyplace.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Tuesday night Space Show with Bob Zimmerman. We have two sponsors that I want to tell you about. AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, which Bob talked about a few minutes ago, is the world's largest aerospace pro society, and they have over 30,000 individual members, 88 countries, and 95 corporate members. They're busy shaping the future of aerospace every single day, especially after they heard Bob's talk last week. And they advance the state of aerospace science, which Bob certainly did, and technology, again, which he did, increasing our knowledge of the universe and bringing the world closer together without SLS. For more information, check them out at AIAA.org. And then Celestis, the company I absolutely love, which is also the premier spaceflight memorial service, is a sponsor. And they have achieved a major milestone toward the launch of their next memorial spaceflight from the Cape. Just last month, the first set of ashes were integrated into the orbital testbed satellite, which is undergoing final construction and testing at Surrey Satellite, U.S. facility in Colorado. Surrey, by the way, is an English company. The satellite will orbit the Earth for at least 5 years and can be tracked on the Celestis website, joining two other Celestis spacecraft currently orbiting the planet. The second set of ashes is going to be integrated into the satellite later this year. If you have a loved one that would like to be memorialized in space, it's a great opportunity. So check it out and then go and attend the launch, because it's really quite something, very moving. Celestis.com, Celestis.org, and again, a great company to deal with. Bob, we have a caller waiting to talk to you. And hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Ah, hey, opposition
John.
To your SLS comments has finally arrived.
Hey,
John, I'd love to hear what you got to say.
Okay, well, one thing I was noticing on a lot of this, I think the issue was a whole bunch of issues, but one thing you get into is a question of scale. I mean, a lot of the projects you pointed out that work very well, both the private project, particularly SpaceX's projects and some others, and of course the unmanned mission at NASA, the way you said, these are all, let's say, more on the lower scale. When you get to something on the scale of an SLS Saturn V, and the only other thing that was ever built on that scale I can think of is the N1, which was a failure. I mean, you and SLS, I guess, is a TBD. I think it becomes a bit beyond any normal size company to really have ownership of something like that.
Well,
if they fail, they go out of business. Let's put it that way. I mean, you know, it was something that big.
There might be truth to what you say. However, SpaceX is demonstrating possibly that's not true. And they're doing it with the Dragon Heavy, with the Falcon Heavy. Because the Falcon Heavy will, when launched, be about have the thrust capability, the payload capability, about half of a Saturn V, which gets you pretty close to a big scale type thing. Pretty close. It'll be the biggest rocket built and actually launched since the Saturn V, and it's going to hopefully launch before the end of this year, first time. And they're demonstrating that, and they're doing it at a remarkably small cost and a very small development time. And so that raises the question about whether the scale is that much different. The other component is that I made a point in the policy paper of comparing SLS Orion with Apollo. And when Apollo was built and Saturn V was built, NASA did not do cost-plus contracts most of the time. They were fixed price. They introduced cost-plus because in some of those contracts at the time, because this was such radical engineering, the companies wanted some insurance and security in case something went wrong. And so, but because the policy had been fixed price, those cost-plus contracts did not get out of control. And so when you compare Apollo Saturn with SLS Orion, you find that SLS Orion does not come off well. And they both have the same big scale. And then if you compare SLS Orion with Dragon Heavy, Falcon Heavy, it also comes off very poorly. Remember, NASA's been saying it's going to go to Mars now for I don't know how many decades. SpaceX is actually going to be going to Mars, I think, in 2018 and every 2 years thereafter. And they're not going to be having this long development time. So, yes, there is a scale difference. I recognize that. But I think that the results between the two are so profoundly different, it says that SLS and Orion are not the right way to do things. They're not effective. And that's where I'm coming from.
John, what about the Mars Colonial Transfer unit that SpaceX wants to big? He says it's going to be the biggest rocket that ever has flown.
I'm very skeptical of both those things, but let's don't get sidetracked on that. But, I mean, when Falcon Heavy flies and we see what it really is, I'll have a better perception. Every time I try to model what that thing would be, I get numbers different than they do, so I want to see. Unless it's a whole different construction than what we've seen in their Falcon 9s, I don't see how they get that mass out of it, but
you might have better engineering knowledge than me, but basically they're strapping three first stages together, and they say they can get 50 tons in orbit at that point. And they've made their engines, Merlin engines, much more efficient, and so therefore they have the payload capacity to put more up, and I think they've demonstrated that. I don't see any reason why I shouldn't believe them.
Well, we'll see shortly.
We'll see.
I guess,
we will see shortly.
If it happens, it happens. The other thing is I think the political environment has been so adverse during this whole Orion and SLS period that it's hard to compare to what was going on with the Apollo. I mean, you've had a lot of changes in policies, a lack of real commitment. Well, again, it's a question of scale. You'll see a lot of projects the government has. I mean, I would point out a classic is, say, the B-2 bomber, for example. But I'm more, I mean, you have a plane which we spent like a total of $44 billion on circa 1986, 80s to generally mid-90s dollars, you know, that period, let's say, not mid-average of 1990, say, 88 or something like that. And you get 21 airplanes.
Yeah.
Now, the real problem wasn't the plane or the design. It was they decided to build just 21 airplanes. They spent $100 billion. They could have easily got 100 planes, you know, or maybe more. It's a question of the, and here we've been fiddling around at such a low scale that this thing has been so drug out that you have to have all that overhead, both the government and the company overhead, to keep the thing viable while you really do very little actual final work.
You're not getting any disagreement with me. That's one of the fundamental problems of SLS Orion right now, and it is a function of how bureaucracy, as Tim was noting with that quote, it's a function of how bureaucracies in government decay with time, and you get this waste, and it's the nature of the beast. When you have a competitive private sector competing for customers, all the incentives work in a completely different direction, and you don't have those kind of problems. And that's the distinction I'm trying to outline and delineate and underline.
And so I definitely think for, like I say, some things that are more smaller scale, it'll work really good. I'm just dubious of, we'll see if the Colonial Transporter actually materializes and SpaceX builds it. I think we'll say you've won the argument.
Well, I'll tell you this. We'll see what happens. They might not build that giant rocket. I myself actually am a little bit skeptical of it,
yeah.
Because I am not convinced it's going to be necessary. If the Falcon Heavy is as effective and as cost-effective as they say, it doesn't pay to build this super-duper very complex, very large-scale rocket that's going to be very expensive. You can get it accomplished with a smaller, more effective rocket such as the Falcon Heavy. That's what I think is going to really happen here. I think they're going to find that it's much more cost-effective to take what is an effective rocket that can put half of Saturn V payload in orbit, launch two of them, and you've launched two of them for still about 20% the cost of the Saturn V. And that's incredibly cheap. And that's what I think they're going to find. That's what's going to, I think, end up happening.
Well, I say, we'll be interested
we'll see.
When the much vaunted Falcon Heavy actually flies and see how it works and
right.
What it actually orbits.
Right.
I mean, there may be some things I'm missing that they've improved, and a lot of things they're doing seem to me they really have successfully pushed the edge of the envelope for the technologies they're using.
Yep.
In terms of mass, the you know. Empty weight to loaded weight ratios and things like that.
Right.
It seems to be pretty impressive, actually.
It's been very impressive.
Not
I mean, they have the ability to put a satellite in geosynchronous orbit and still have enough fuel to land the first stage I can't tell you how many years I've heard that can't be done. There won't be enough fuel. I heard that so many times over the last 30 years. I believed it too, and they proved it's completely false that it can be done. And that part of the reason they did it is they made their engines much more efficient, and they found ways to get more thrust out of those engines for what they needed. And they also did smart engineering on how you land. They actually looked at it and figured out that, you know, maybe you can do it for less fuel than everyone's been saying. I think that's part of what's going on. And all this has to do with, you know, their aim at innovation and competition and producing a better product, private sector. And that's why they've done it. And that's what you don't get in the big space, old paradigm way of doing things.
Well, one advantage they obviously have is it's still a really small company with the creative genius that built the company actively managing it right now. And
right.
I think that's something that happens with almost all these historic aerospace companies. At one point or another, they all start out with somebody like that in that kind of environment, and then they evolve into something else.
You're absolutely correct. And you know what, John? What happens, that's why you need a competitive industry, because what happens is those companies, just like government agencies actually, they begin to get dry rot and get less competitive, and people are focused on the organization and not the product, and so therefore they're no longer as competitive. But in an open competitive system, new companies show up with those geniuses running them, and the old companies fall by the wayside because they can't compete anymore. In the government, the old companies don't fall by the wayside. They have their tax dollars, and they sit there, and they suck the money out of us. And what I'm hoping is going to happen is that we're going to finally start to not fund those failed bureaucracies anymore.
And then you have
X-Corp. Also the political dimension. You can't forget that, too.
What's that?
The political dimension almost requires spreading things out through multiple congressional districts to keep adequate support.
Yes, but you know what? If you have a really robust competitive industry, it's going to naturally spread itself out to a lot of different places. I mean, it's going to naturally do that, not even because it wants to influence congressmen, but because it they're going to come from many places and establish themselves in many different places and produce, you know, hire a lot of people in many different places. And I once again use the computer industry as a great example of that, because the computer industry focused on lowering cost and making its products more innovative and efficient step by step. And so what that did is it made it possible for lots of companies to show up. And a lot of the original companies are gone, because they, in the end, couldn't compete with the newer companies that came along with new ideas. And you had a constant treadmill churn of new companies and new ideas. And that has made it possible for us to go from no computers in 1975 to owning a smartphone today that can, you know, do miracles almost. And that's just competition, I think, more than anything else.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to how your paper does and how the Falcon Heavy does.
Yeah, me too.
And I'll let go of the line and see who else wants to call in.
Thank you, John. I appreciate your call.
Thank you, John. Yes, I do too.
Listeners, that opens the lineup. And again, it is 1-866-687-7223. Bob, switches to planetary, unless you get another phone call.
No, we'll talk about whatever the caller wants to talk about. But, you know, there's lots of stuff going on with the planetary sciences right now, and I just want to talk about it because it's so exciting. It's good stuff. I mean, Juno is going to arrive in Pluto in, what, a week?
Not at Pluto.
Not Pluto. My mistake. I forget. That was not
July 4th.
Jupiter. Juno's going to Jupiter.
And, on July 4th.
It's only the second orbiter we've ever sent to Jupiter. The first one, Galileo, did some great work, but because its main antenna didn't open, the data stream was always constricted, so it didn't send back as much data or images or information as it could have. And so even though it really told us a great deal, there was a limited amount of knowledge. And Juno, there's nothing wrong with it, and it's going to go into orbit around Jupiter on July 4th. It's going to be in a high inclination orbit, and it's going to be diving quite deep into the magnetic field and environments of Jupiter, because its main mission is to study the magnetic field and the atmosphere and the weather of Jupiter. And so therefore, it's interesting. It has a camera to take pictures, but the camera is really there just for public relations. It's not the focus of the mission. The science has to do with other things, spectroscopy and radiation readings and magnetic field study. The camera is going to take lots of pictures, mostly for the public, but you know what? It's going to give us pictures of the poles better than we've ever seen, and therefore it's going to give us pictures of the weather patterns on Jupiter better than we've ever seen, and that's going to be quite amazing. And that's only a week away. And then, you know, you got Dawn still at Cirrus taking pictures. I posted on Behind the Black their best close in view of the brightest spot on Cirrus. Cirrus has these bright spots that are really bright, and they had no idea what they were. It almost looks like a light beacon when from far away. Get close, it really has to do with the contrast. The planet slash dwarf planet slash asteroid is very, very dark, and then you get these white areas, almost like ice. It's not ice, it's thought to be salt, but because it's very white, the contrast is very bright, and therefore it looks bright. And they took a really close image of the brightest one in Ankara Crater, and it's really interesting. It kind of looks like a salt dome on Earth, if you're familiar with what that is geologically, where salt comes from below, and it comes to the surface, and it pushes itself through, creates a dome that then subsides, and you get like a lower elevation place. And this is in the center of the crater, and that's what it looks like. You got lineal cracks going in concentric rings, as well as radiating out from the center, and that suggests that the center collapsed somewhat. And the theory is that the salt was part of a brine of water from below, and the water evaporated away and left the salt behind. That's the theory. They haven't confirmed it yet, But to look at the picture, it's really interesting. You're getting to we see that. And then, of course, you got New Horizons at Pluto. They keep releasing more images, and it's just the weirdest place in the solar system right now. It's weirder than ever any science fiction story, David, I ever read, and they were trying to make it weird. But now it's thought there might even be, below the surface, a liquid ocean on Pluto that... the water is essentially the bedrock on that planet. But there's just enough energy, it appears, to periodically churn that water so that the mountains melt and sink because they have higher density when they melt and sink below, and then they interact with the nitrogen-frozen oceans, and they eventually freeze and then rise back up again. And you see these giant mountain blocks floating in the nitrogen ocean. Talk about science fiction. It's just so cool. So that's just a few. I mean, then you got, you know, Cassini. Cassini is moving towards its finale where it's going to fly. It's going to literally
fly
dive.
Fly into the rings, yeah.
It's going to dive into the atmosphere of Saturn and burn up. But to do that, it's changed. It's now finished all its flybys pretty much of the moon, and they're starting to change its inclination orbit so that it's more of a higher inclination orbit. And so what's it producing? And I posted a few of these on Behind the Black. It's producing these really incredibly beautiful images of Saturn looking down from a high inclination with the rings. And oh my, it's just so great. And it's cool. And when it flies into that atmosphere, we're going to get a sense of what that gas giant is somewhat like, and have some idea. You know, it's big. We always forget these gas giants are humongous. Earth is a tiny thing next to them, and so we are really tiny next to them. And so our weather systems are really tiny. And you're talking about giant global storms that you could fit many Earths into, and they're going to be flying into it. And then you got Rosetta, that's at Comet 67 PCG.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's on its last legs. It's going to mission end sometime in September, but it's now taking close-up images of the comet to compare with the close-up images it took before its close approach to the sun. And what they're doing is they're trying to compare the two to see how the surface of the comet changed during the close approach. And they've even asked the public to participate. You can go, you can get to download the images, and you can look yourself, and if you can spot differences, you let them know, you'd be participating in the science. And, you know, that they found organic material at that comet suggests a lot of things about the formation of the solar system and the development of life here on Earth. Because if a comet like this can produce organics, that increases the likelihood that organics are not difficult to find in the solar system. And you might just find organics under the surface of moons like Enceladus and Europa, about Saturn and Jupiter, respectively. As it is, they're also now talking. The Congress has been pushing NASA to launch a mission to Europa that would land and push and try to make contact with that undersea ocean they think is there. And that might become the first official SLS mission right now. They need missions for it, and Congress has been trying to push for that. And Wilson, we might see that actually happen. The planetary program that NASA's put together is to me the one area that NASA should focus more than anything else on, because it's science and it's research and it's they do it well, and I would really like there to be more money for that. And I think NASA could actually fund the planetary and its astronomy programs more generously, and do manned space, and actually have a smaller budget. Because they do spend money on things that aren't very effective, and that's where I'm coming from.
You have an email that's come in.
Okay.
George is in Denver, and George says, are you supportive of continuing to fund the ISS, or what do you want to do with it?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, that's a good question. I posted something on Behind the Black just was it yesterday or today? I forget which. The Russians, Energia, their main company, the design bureau that built the Russian portion of ISS has proposed that when Russia finally launches its promised modules for its half of that partnership, which are literally a decade plus, maybe two decades behind schedule, when they finally launch those modules, they're going to be arriving at ISS right near the end of the station's life. And why should they then be just abandoned if we abandon the station? And so Energia proposes that they separate those modules from ISS and become its own space station, a Russian space station, break the partnership up when ISS gets abandoned. I personally think we've wasted the opportunity that ISS has given us, because if we're going to go to Mars, we need to know how to fly to Mars, and you build a space station to figure that out, and we just have not used that opportunity well. The Chinese are building a space station with that goal in mind, how to build an interplanetary spaceship. The Russians have always had that in mind when they built the Salyut stations and they built Mir, and then they got into our partnership and they've been prevented kind of from doing that with ISS. So they have reasons from a practical engineering perspective, exploring the solar systems, for getting out of that partnership. ISS was not designed with that in mind, so it never really was helping NASA learn how to build an interplanetary spaceship. It's too dependent on the ground. It's too controlled too much from the ground. So, you know, you abandon it, you don't have it anymore, and there's plenty you can still use it for to learn how to go to the planets. I mean, there's medical research that can be done. You can use it as a test bed to develop better technology for figuring out how to build interplanetary spaceships. And so I'd hate it if we abandoned it. But we are always going to be somewhat crippled in using it, because it isn't designed well for its purpose, which is teaching you how to make an interplanetary spaceship. And I don't know if that answers George's question, but that's where I see it. If the private sector continues to grow and dominate over the next 5 years, by the time the government wants to abandon ISS, it's possible that private sector might take it over. It's also possible that we will abandon it without any trouble at all, because the Bigelow habitable modules will have replaced it much more effectively for much less cost, and they will be good prototypes for interplanetary ships.
When I've had shows on with NASA people associated with the station, they always get a question, why can't a private company take it over? And their answer is always the same, and they say, look, this thing was not designed with anything like a private sector in mind. It's too costly. The overhead is horrible. The maintenance is horrible.
Right.
It's extremely sensitive.
Right.
And if you wanted a space station today in 2016 for the private sector, you could design one and build it so much cheaper and so much more effectively, with so much more power and so much more efficiency,
right,
that no private company in their right mind would want this thing.
Right. And since you do have Bigelow building their modules, there's...
And that makes the case.
That's right. And I agree with that. And I think that that's fine. What concerns me is that we'll let ISS go, and then we'll not allow private sector or encourage the private sector to pick up the slack. That would be what would concern me. But I think the private sector is going to pick up the slack, just because there is a demand for this, and therefore...
Well, they got the private sector beam up there right now.
That's right.
So, you know, Bigelow's testing out. So I don't know that they would, through regulation, try to restrict the private sector from accessing a space station.
No, but the thing that would concern me is that, you know, one of the customers of Bigelow is the government, is NASA, as well as other countries. And my concern would be, and I think that it's essential as a nation that we do have a presence in space. And so we are a customer of a company like Bigelow, and I would hope that our government buys the product. We should, if this is the right way to do it, it would be much more effective and cost effective, and would cost taxpayers a lot less, and it would actually be teaching us what we need to know about building interplanetary spaceships. It would be the right approach, and I would hope that our federal government would buy the product. Once again, that's what my policy paper is all about, trying to get the government to think in terms of getting what it needs from the private sector effectively. And I think this ISS has not been effective tool for getting what we need in orbit and in space from a space station. And I think that hopefully down the road we will get what we need.
Linda is in Seattle and says, Bob, do you know of any major commercial space or NASA events planned for around the November election time?
Well, I will tell you that NASA, no, I don't think so. I don't know of anything that comes to mind immediately from NASA. What does come to mind immediately is the Falcon Heavy first demo launch. That is, I'm pulling up the launch schedule on Spaceflight Now right now just to see what's coming in the late in the year. And okay, there is several things. One, September 8th, OSIRIS REx is going to launch on an Atlas V. That's the first American sample return asteroid mission. That's in September. Sometime in the fall, SpaceX is, and they have it tentatively scheduled for September. It's almost certainly going to be the SES-10 communication satellite launch, in which they're going to reuse a first stage. That's a big deal. And then you've got a tentative launch set for the first Falcon Heavy launch set for November. No date set, but it's set in November. And so those are the big, I think, things coming up in the fall. I think that SpaceX has announced they're going to give out a – they're going to release sometime in September – their long-range Mars plan.
Right, that's at the Guadalajara conference.
Yeah.
Later in September.
Yeah, and that and that's going to be tied in, I'm sure, with that first reusable launch, and it's going to be tied in with much more details about the first Falcon Heavy launch. And I think so that's, I think, going to be the big space news. Now you've got Blue Origin private sector stuff that's continuing their test flights of their New Shepard rocket and suborbital craft, and that's going to be continuing throughout the year. They say they're going to start doing test flights manned next year, beginning of the year. Later on this year, there are several small sat rocket companies that are tentatively saying they're going to launch, and that would be, to me, a big deal. It might not be as exciting to the general public, but it would be a big deal. In terms of the big space program like SLS Orion, that first unmanned Orion flight on an SLS rocket is not scheduled until the fall of 2018. And so, and hopefully it'll be on schedule. I think the unmanned flight will be on schedule. The first manned flight in 2021, there's a lot of indications in NASA literature, a lot of indications that tell me that it's going to be delayed till 2023.
Just in time for midterm elections.
Well, you know, it once again will underline my point in the policy paper, which is that, all right, 2023 means George Bush proposed this in 2004. That's two decades to build a capsule and put people on it. It's disgraceful in my mind. That's embarrassing. A capsule. 2 decades. It should never take that long. It just should not take that long. And especially since you're not reinventing the wheel. This is technology we've done before. We can do it better now. We have computers. We can do it better and easier. So it's disgraceful it's taking so long. But anyway, to answer Linda's questions, those are the basic big events, I think, coming up this year, and they're almost all private space, exciting private space stuff.
Okay, Ben sent in an email from Boston and said, Bob, do you have any concerns one way or the other about two things? Number one, the development of North Korean missiles, and number two, what China is doing in space, given that most of what China does is through the Chinese military?
They're both good questions. Well, North Korea, I have enormous concerns, especially because of the administration we have in power doesn't really understand the threat.
Well, are their missiles really – what do you find on Behind the Black? Are they making real
progress?
Whenever
they do a test flight, I post on it. And so I try to research what has been accomplished. The most recent test, I think a week ago, they did 2 test launches within a couple of hours of each other.
Right.
The first one broke up almost immediately, like 100 miles up in the air, was very clearly announced by our military as a failure. The second one went about, I think, 300 miles or so, and there are mixed reports that it was a success. This is all the same ballistic missile. It's not intercontinental, but if they get it launched and working properly, it's supposed to have a range of around 3,000 miles, which would basically make it a threat to the entire East Asian region. And they made it pretty clear that they are developing, they're trying to develop nuclear weapons that are small enough they can put on this missile.
And they are
led by a nut who believes very strongly in bellicose power grabs.
Why are they having so much trouble building a missile? I mean, missile technology is out of the box.
They're a bankrupt country. Remember, they are a communist nation, which is they can hardly feed their populace. And so I think actually considering the bankrupt, the failed social system they use, it's pretty remarkable they've gotten as far as they have. The threat of death from the leader is, of course, a strong incentive to work hard and succeed. And he has the ability to just, with a blink of an eye, have you killed. And so that forces people
and
to work
he's
very
done
hard.
That. Yeah, he's done that even with his own family.
Absolutely right. He's not a nice guy. And so he's a real threat. If he gets this capability, it's a real threat. And what I find baffling, not so much, I don't expect much from this administration in these matters. They live in a pie-in-the-sky, ivory tower world. They don't understand there are really evil people in the world, our federal government today, the Obama administration. But I don't understand why the Chinese and the Russians are tolerating this, because it's just as much a threat to them in the long run as it is to South Korea and Japan. He gets these weapons. He can turn it on anybody, and he's not a reliable ally. He's crazy. And so I don't understand why the Chinese are not taking real action to squelch this. That's what I can't figure out. Now, the other question, the Chinese. There is no doubt the Chinese space program is you know, it's a mixed, it's a military program, just like the Soviet Union's was. And just like the Soviet Union's, they are using their space program mostly for public relations and also for industrial development. And the result of that, and because it's public relations, they want to sell it as a peaceful, beneficial program for the human race. And that is kind of forcing their hand in a direction that the military might not even want to go. And this is what happened to the Soviet Union. The space program in the Soviet Union led the way towards the change in the Soviet Union. It really did. It was the first to go capitalistic. It was the first to try to sell its product to the first world, to outside the Soviet Union. And it really, in many ways, helped change the Soviet Union. And I think their space program is going to do the same. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, China did an anti-satellite test in which they literally sent a rocket up, a satellite up, maneuvered it near another satellite, and blew both of them up. And put debris everywhere in the worst possible orbit and were lambasted by every nation in the world, spacefaring nation in the world, and they looked like fools. And I've been at conferences where Chinese people have said, we really screwed up there, and our government realized how they wouldn't listen to anybody who was telling them, don't do this, it'll look bad. They did it, it looked bad. And so, for example, this week when they launched their Long March 7 rocket on its first launch, one of the tests, it was a test launch, so they tested a prototype capsule and it returned safely, but another thing they launched was a small satellite with a robot arm, which they say is designed to clean up space junk. And I read an article today about how, yes, it can clean up space junk, which is trying to counter the bad publicity from the previous anti-sat launch. But that article also noted that with a robot arm and maneuverability, it could also be a very effective anti-satellite military craft, but a clean one. In other words, it doesn't send debris everywhere. It can go, and if it doesn't like your military reconnaissance satellite, it can go and capture it and force it to deorbit. And because it's small, they can launch a lot of them. Effectively. So, all right, the space program, so space kind of, and the public relations involved with space forced them to change the way they built the anti-satellite spacecraft and to make it more beneficial to actually clean up space junk. And I think I think in the long run, space is, at least in this period of human history, is a force for good. It kind of forces nations, even the worst ones, to go in the right direction. As long as their leaders aren't insane, as in North Korea. And the Chinese leadership is not insane. They're kind of like the Soviet era leaders, very bureaucratic, thinking in terms of how can we make the most effective governmental operation. That's their thinking, and so that's their approach. And so I think it's a force for good in that.
All right, three questions for you have come in.
All right.
So see if you can give short answers.
Okay.
Jerry doesn't really require an answer. He's offering information. Falcon Heavy Corps is on the truck on the way to McGregor for structural testing. Current goal is for launch Christmas week, 2016.
Oh, that's a bit of new news. The only thing I've seen is November. Now we're looking Christmas week. They definitely want to get it off this year, though. I can tell that.
Okay. Tim from Huntsville, who called a little while ago, now says, if the U.S. didn't scrap the Saturn rocket and Skylab, could NASA develop Skylab into an interplanetary spacecraft?
They could have. Then, Wernher von Braun built the Saturn V with colonizing the solar system in mind. And Skylab was designed to be a spacecraft that could, an interplanetary spacecraft. It had the capability of doing exactly that. And they could have, but we can't do it now because trying to rebuild that, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah. It's a variation of what I think it was John who said it. I mean, it doesn't pay to build the International Space Station. It doesn't pay to build the same thing over again when we can do it smarter. And we can do it smarter, and I think SpaceX is showing us how you can do it smarter.
Absolutely. Okay, your next question is from Mac in York, Pennsylvania. Bob, your analysis on orbital commercial has been very informative. What is your analysis on, you're going to love this, suborbital tourism a la Blue Origin and Virgin? And I notice that X-Corps is absent from this. I say that for your entertainment.
Yeah, well, all right. I'm waiting for Charles Alario to apologize to me at some point, but no, I'm kidding. I was skeptical of X-Corps, you know, for decades. I always wanted to succeed, but I always had doubts, and it's fallen by the wayside. The new management has put links
put the
aside.
Put the kibosh on links.
They've said they're going to focus on things where they can make a profit right now, and I think that's okay. It's a shame. I would like to have seen Lynx fly, but I always had doubts it was going to happen because I was watching the company with an open eye. Now, in terms of Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic had a 10-year head start with lots and lots of money. From what I've read, $500 million of investment capital. And like the tortoise and hare, they wasted those of that decade. And basically, they're way behind the eight ball right now with a design that's not working, it appears, for their suborbital tourism.
My money's on Blue all the way.
Say again? Your money's on Blue. Well, I agree with you. I think Blue Origin has built well and smart. They've already test flown it, reused it four times, and in all four cases, they got up to space. Not four. The first one, they were just a tiny bit short of 100 kilometers. But since then, the last three flights have all reached suborbital height. And so they've achieved what they set out to do, and they're testing it. They're doing an actual test program, something we were promised from Virgin Galactic for almost 5 years, and nothing happened. And so, yes, my money's on Blue Origin right now, and I think they've got a craft that they will be able to sell tickets very effectively and make money from it. But they've made it very clear this is really only a stepping stone. They're making money from suborbital, but their goal is to develop the BE-4 engine and then develop a reusable orbital rocket, launch industry rocket. And they are possibly the player that will make a run at SpaceX's money down the road because they have developed reusability of the first stage. They have the technology to understand how to build, just like SpaceX, land that first stage and reuse it. And they've already reusing it. And so even though it's not orbital, they're learning they're already reusing stuff. With SpaceX hasn't gotten that far yet. So I think down the road, yes, suborbital, they will make some money. There is money to be made there, but I think in the end, the big money will be orbital, and that's where they're moving, and I'm looking for that. Virgin Galactic, they're going to eventually, hopefully, they have an option on another launch contract for 200 nanosatellites. This is their second launch contract for Launcher 1, and this is, if they can get that off the ground by 2018, they will finally be a player in the launch market, but it'll be a small sat player. And that's a good thing, but in terms of the suborbital tourism, they are a very big disappointment and failure. It's a sad thing, but that happens. That's what competition's all about.
Do you have any news on Dream Chaser in Sierra Nevada?
Yeah, the Dream Chaser has gotten their engineering prototype in shape, and it's there was an article I posted on Behind the Black about a week ago in which they it has now been shipped to NASA for glide tests. They're going to do further glide tests. So it's moving forward. They've got a contract to build the cargo craft, and the cargo craft is interesting. I looked into it a little bit more closely recently for the policy paper. It's a reusable cargo craft, but it's also got a cargo module that gets abandoned, which is interesting. It gets separated when they undock from ISS. The cargo module will detach and burn up in the atmosphere while the mini shuttle comes down and lands and gets unloaded. And that's an interesting little bonus. What that does is it allows them to bring more cargo up, but it allows also the garbage to be offloaded. They have a cargo capsule to offload garbage and things on ISS they don't want anymore. So it looks like you're going to see, I have to search Behind the Black right now. I don't think I can do that while I'm on the phone, but I think that they're hoping to start doing glide tests before the end of this year, I think. Don't quote me, but I think that's the deal.
We're pushing 2 hours. So
yes.
What should we look for between now and the end of the year? What you've said, the Falcon Heavy demo around Christmas time?
Yeah, I mean, I answered that question basically for Linda. Those are the basic big things towards the fall. Obviously, Blue Origin flights that are going to be happening. Of course, we have the planetary stuff that I've already talked about. You've got a Mars orbiter that Europe launched, ExoMars, that's going to arrive in October. And that's an interesting one because it was launched on a Russian rocket, and if it gets into orbit and actually produces science, it will break the Russian schneid. They will finally participate in a Mars mission that succeeds. And they have a 100% track record of failure so far. So I'm praying, I really would like that to succeed for the Russians' sake, because they've just had so much bad luck when every mission they send to Mars. You have a Russian hand in a Mars mission, and it's been failure. And even if they're not a major player, their hand is like the curse. But I'm hoping this succeeds. And so that's the kind of stuff that's going to be coming down the road over the rest of the year. But in terms of the next six, I'll tell you one of the important things that's going to happen. I'm hoping that when my policy paper, Exploring Space in the 21st Century, gets published in August and gets distributed to the political community in Washington, D.C., as well as to the space community, it'll be available on Behind the Back, Black, as a PDF download if people want. I'm hoping that will have a significant influence on the policy discussion of space down the road. That's really what I'm hoping for. And since it's being distributed by a very respected Washington think tank, I'm hoping very much that it's going to be paid attention to.
Do you think, I know we're not going to talk politics, but this is generic politics. Is there any chance, in your opinion, that whoever the new president is might turn into a real space growth, space industry pro-president?
Yes, I think that's very possible, because success breeds success. One of the problems that NASA's had for the last four decades is a general lack of success. I mean, the planetary program's been good, and ISS was somewhat successful, but the shuttle they worked to make it as boring as possible. And from a politician's perspective, this doesn't sell tickets. This doesn't get them votes. Space especially should be exciting. And inspire the nation. And that's what politicians want from space for their own voting, success. And so that the private industry and competition is beginning to produce some exciting things, that's going to get politicians exciting. And as long as politicians then buy the products properly from the private sector to produce more excitement, we'll finally go places. And so that's really possible. A Trump presidency, by the way, because he's a businessman and has been, it's very possible that, yes, he will go buy into that very quickly. He will not go with the big government program. He will buy into the idea of private space. As for Hillary Clinton, it's a lot hard to say, but since this has been the policy of the Obama administration to favor the private commercial space program, it's more likely she will buy into that as well. That's my hope. And I think, once again, it always comes down to success. If the private sector continues to be as successful as I expect it to be, that will sell them more than anything else. I'll tell a quick story. When I accepted the Eugene Emmy Award for my book, Leaving Earth, I attended a American Astronomical Society conference. While I was there, this was back in the Sean O'Keefe days, in 03, there was a presentation at one of the talks by a public relations guy who had been hired by Sean O'Keefe to improve NASA's brand, its brand name reputation. And he had this typical public relations PowerPoint, which was just ludicrous and vaporware and ridiculous. And when the question and answer time came up, I raised my hand because I can't keep my mouth shut, and I said, excuse me, you want to improve NASA's brand? Do something. Produce something. Don't give me public relations blather. You got to build something and launch it and succeed. And you haven't been doing that. A lot of people there didn't like what I had to say there. I think that's one of the reasons they haven't invited me back. But nonetheless, that's the bottom line. And I think that's what's going to happen in space over the next few years, because the private sector will be doing things because there's profit to be made.
So several years ago at the SmallSat conference, John Jurist and I were there, and we're walking through the exhibit hall, and I see some of my friends who have a new space rocket company that has not done anything, but lots and lots of rhetoric. And they came up to me, and we said hello, you know, all the friendly stuff. And they said, you know, we're really not getting a good rep in the new space community and all of this. You know, what do you recommend that we do in order to do better in the new space community and have a better reputation? This bad rep is horrible. And I said, quit blowing it out, your blank, 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 and go do something, fly something,
launch
a rocket, you know, do anything that goes higher than a Southwest Airlines flight.
That's right.
And you know, and otherwise all you're doing is just blowing out smoke, and everybody knows it. So you want to be credible? Fly something, since you're a rocket company.
That's right. And that's the bottom line. That was NASA's problem as well. And I think the reason that I think my policy paper is going to have impact is because the timing's right. And it's right. We have two different approaches. One has worked and one that hasn't. I didn't mention the EELV program, by the way, the third prong, Air Force's ULA monopoly contract.
Yeah, no, you did mention that.
I did, but I didn't mention what my paper found, which is the bottom line. ULA says it costs $225 million as an average payload. SpaceX finally wins the right to bid, and on their first bid, they do it for $82 million. And so it is more expensive to do an Air Force contract because they have higher tolerances and higher specifications, but even so, they were almost a third less. They were almost two-thirds less. And so that demonstrates once again how competition works. And so I'm hoping that the policy paper will be coming at the right time to convince policymakers in the legislature and in the staffs that advise those policymakers, those legislators, the better way for the government to do things, to provide a robust launch industry. Because we don't want a space program. Let's have a private sector industry that's chaotic and is following its dreams. You know, so SpaceX is launching its Dragon capsule every 2 years with maybe payloads on it to do science research, but it's doing it privately. And then you got Blue Origin doing its thing. You know, he wants to do manufacturing in orbit. Well, go for it, man. Make money. And you start to get that, and then that pays off to the politicians if they're supporting that, because it makes them look good. And that's why I think they'll have self-interest involved to go along with this. Because they haven't gotten anything from NASA, the big space programs, for decades. You know, I watched the test firing of the orbital ATK solid rocket booster today, and they have the typical NASA announcer they fire the rocket and says, and there we begin the test firing of the solid rocket booster for SLS that's taking us to Mars. And I've been hearing that from these announcers for decades, and have we gone to Mars, and is this going to get us to Mars? No, it's not. SpaceX is going to send more Dragon capsules to Mars, I bet, before SLS even launches its first person. It's going to probably get three capsules to Mars before SLS even puts anyone in space. And on that note, I think we're done.
Yes, I was going to say, with that, I will say one more thing. You know,
yeah.
Trump, when he talks about space and Mars, says he doesn't have any problem with Mars, except that we've got to, you know, cut our spending and our debt. And
you're talking about Trump.
Trump, yeah.
Yeah, he says that too.
Yeah, and fix our potholes and our infrastructure and all that stuff. So, you know, if somebody made the case with him about expand, and he always talks about jobs and the economy
right.
and all that, if somebody got to him and could make the logical case that the commercial industry is about jobs and economy
right.
and growth in a whole new sector, I really can't see him wanting to stop that.
No, and in fact, you just quoted my paper. I'm talking about exactly that, that the politicians would actually benefit politically, and the nation would benefit politically, economically, everything would benefit politically by doing this, that the old system has not actually benefited us economically and in terms of our industry and our nation, that if you allow a robust private sector to grow and compete, everyone benefits. And I think, yes, I think Trump could be sold on that. And once again, you know, he's going to have advisors, and hopefully they will see this. And that's my hope. That's my hope right now. I'm really hoping this is going to make a splash. That's my real hope. And it's not so much that I'm against Boeing or Lockheed building Orion and SLS. It's because I think that there are better ways to do things, and those companies are capable of doing it in better ways. And Boeing actually proves that. They really have, as I say, they have divisions that are going for the private sector competition very effectively.
Bachelor's communicating with me on Hotel Mars tomorrow, says hello to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he just emailed, well, anyway, this has nothing to do with your show. He just emailed me to say that they did post my article today, my broadcast
tonight.
Oh,
so I'll need
it means
to...
he has room for you tomorrow. Which
well, that's what we're talking about, doing a double sector tomorrow. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have to go get your show, and I download them. So, and then I listen to them on my iPhone or, you know, while I'm doing other work. So I get to hear most of your programming on Bachelor's show. And listeners, by the way, you know, Bob's segments are longer than Hotel Mars segments, and he talks about a lot of really interesting science and other programs other than what Bachelor talks about with Hotel Mars. Bachelor chooses the topic on Hotel Mars, and so the segments are not alike, and I would really urge you to listen to Bob's you know, programming on Bachelor.
I will tell you that I post those podcasts on Behind the Black as soon as he puts them up. So if you go to behindtheblack.com, you can find the podcast, every podcast I've done.
Yeah, and it's easier to navigate Bob's site than it is John's site. So.
Well, I'm not, you know.
Anyway. Well, it is easier because you don't have all the other stuff up there, so you have to hunt and find the show with you on Bachelor Sect. So, you know, with you, it's just right there.
Yeah, right. I keep it very simple. I want my website to load fast. I don't like a lot of websites today are getting too complicated.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, mine is fast. You want to see what's on Behind the Black, you'll see it instantly, and it's worth reading. Without question.
Bob, and I guess I'll need to send you some dates through September because that's what I'm booking now.
Okay.
So we can do, let's see, September and then probably December.
Okay.
All right.
Send me stuff and I'll come on again. You know me.
All right. Talk to you later.
All
and
right.
Thank you
all the listeners again.
That's right. Everyone who called in and the emailers, we appreciate hearing from you. And Hotel Mars tomorrow and... no show for July 4th weekend, including Sunday and Monday, but there is a Friday program. Goodbye, everybody. Have a great rest of the week.